From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with former program director for WAMU, Steve Martin. We'll tell you how, when, and where this program, known as the Politics Hour, got started. We'll also be talking soon with David Meyer, the CEO of the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission, in particular about last Sunday's derailment of Metro. And joining us now is Kenyon McDuffie, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 5, who has announced that he is running for Attorney General. Councilmember McDuffie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kojo. Good to talk to you again, Tom.
Yesterday, you announced that you will be running for Attorney General in 2022. Current Attorney General Carl Racine said last week he would not be running for any public office. So did you talk to Carl Racine about this, and do you have his approval?
I've talked to Carl Racine. I've talked to a host of other people across the District of Columbia who are excited and energized about my candidacy. And ultimately, I think the approval that's necessary is the majority of voters across this city. And I know this city has very discerning voters. And when they heard about my announcement yesterday, I've gotten an outpouring of support so far. So
why have you chosen?
I'm excited.
Why have you chosen to run for Attorney General and not for mayor?
Well, I have looked at all this, the landscape, right, frankly. And let me talk to Ward 5 voters for a moment and tell them that I've been truly honored to represent them on the council for 9.5 years and representing the city, the ward that I've been born and raised in, has been truly one of my greatest privileges. Now, I chose Attorney General because I love our city. I love the people who call it home, and it is aligned with my experience, my background, my qualifications, and my desire to continue to serve the District of Columbia and to work relentlessly to protect the city and to ensure fairness and justice for every one of its residents.
There's a lot. Welcome to the show, council member. Obviously, the Attorney General, Carl Racine, the first Attorney General for two elected terms, set a pretty high bar on activism across the board, local, regional, national, in many different areas. But let me ask a more bold, blunter question than the polite Kojo just asked. If Mayor Bowser surprises us and she decides she's not going to run for a third term, would you switch and run for mayor, or are you all in on the Attorney General's race?
I am all in on the Attorney General's race.
Okay.
And when you start a question with if, Tom, I got to tell you, it means that no one knows whether or not it's going to happen. So you'd have to talk to Mayor Bowser to ask her what her plans are. My plan is to run across the city.
I got it. You're in. That's
for Attorney General.
There's only one other candidate right now, Ryan Jones, who announced who filed to run as a public finance candidate back in April. Not too much is known about him, but we'll see how that campaign develops. And you said you intend to run a public finance campaign with public financing that limits the kinds of contributions you'll get. Is that correct?
That is correct. I'm accepting contributions from individuals only, and they have started to, those contributions started to pour in as soon as I made the announcement. I think in the first hour we had about 100 donations that came in, and so and since then it's already doubled, and so I think the enthusiasm is really spreading quickly across the district.
Okay, let me one more quick question about who might run, and I apologize for interrupting.
Because we've got a phone call pouring in for you, but
okay,
go ahead.
But this is important. There might be other candidates in the race. I have been speaking to a variety of people in the city, and two names that have come up, and I just want to mention them as the great mentioners that they might run, are fairly well known in the legal world, but not politicians. One is Natalie Ludaway, who was for 5 years the deputy to Carl Racine. And the other is a very distinguished lawyer, Elizabeth Wilkins, who I believe works in the AG's office now, but has her own very distinguished legal career. I know you don't want to mention other candidates, but do you have any idea whether either Elizabeth Wilkins or Natalie Ludaway or somebody else might run? Or is the field clear for you?
Those two I do know and have had opportunity to work with them, particularly when I chaired the Judiciary Committee. When able to do some incredible work about ushering in a public health-based approach to criminal justice reform and intervention. And so I've had an opportunity to work with them. Here's the thing. There's no shortage of lawyers in the District of Columbia, right? But I think nobody's going to bring to the table my unique set of experiences and qualifications to be able to represent the interests of the District of Columbia and all of its residents. I've lived here my entire life, and I have a prism through which to view the city's landscape. I know how residents feel about the zealousness that they want the Attorney General to exhibit in representing their interests. And, you know, I've had an opportunity to talk to residents across all eight wards already, and they're excited about this campaign. People who I work with to do comprehensive juvenile justice reform signed up quickly. And so people know my record, and they're excited about that.
Glad you mentioned comprehensive juvenile justice reform, because Ron in Northwest sent us an email. While professing to care about black lives, city leaders like Mr. McDuffie have consistently pushed for even more leniency for violent offenders in our city. If elected Attorney General, what, if anything, will Mr. McDuffie do to lower the high rate of violent juvenile crime in D.C., aside from funding more, quote-unquote, violence interrupters?
I'm proud of my record in bringing together a coalition of advocates, academics, and residents across the District of Columbia to author the Neighborhood Engagement Achieved Results Act, the NEAR Act for short. It ushered in that public health-based approach to crime prevention and intervention. And it has been demonstrated through evidence and research to help keep communities safe. And when I speak to residents across the District of Columbia, that's exactly what they want. They want innovative solutions to address the intractable issues. And it is not any way designed to supplant what law enforcement does, but it works in a parallel track to make sure that we're using all the tools in our toolkit to address violence, to hold people accountable when they commit it, but also to look at those neighborhoods that have been plagued by violence for years and pour opportunities into those communities so that individuals see themselves on a pathway to success.
The police chief agrees with you that all these violence prevention things are important, but he also criticizes the council members for reducing the force. He says he's about 300 officers less than he used to have, and he's concerned about that. And he says these long-term solutions are not solving the patrols on the street now. And I ask other people this on the show. What do you tell the grandmother who can't sit on her front porch because of the crime in her neighborhood now? Does she have to wait for the long-term solutions to mature?
I would tell that grandmother and any other person who sits in that position that I'm going to fight to ensure justice for her and her community. That I'm going to fight to hold people who commit crimes accountable. I have a track record of doing that. When you hear about public health-based approaches to crime prevention and intervention, it is not designed to replace in any way law enforcement. It is an alternative to simply thinking that locking people up is going to get rid of the circumstances, the poverty that exists that cause people in many cases to commit crimes and violence.
The grandmother wants the police officer patrolling her neighborhood, I think is what she's saying.
I want the police officer to understand what real community policing looks like.
Okay.
Right? So they know that grandmother's name when they walk on her block, so that they build relationships that foster positive engagements and aren't just showing up after shots are fired. They're not just showing up to place yellow tape in communities. They're not just showing up to have confrontations with the people who live in those neighborhoods. I think there's a way that law enforcement can build those relationships. And I appreciate Chief Conte's passion and his experience. And I think he's doing a solid work. But I think that people should not simply rely on the Metropolitan Police Department to solve all their crime problems.
I don't think anybody's saying that now. It's both and, I think is the way you say it.
It is both and. But when the focus is on the police, right, I think most people tend to think that the police is the only solution. Yep. Let me be clear. The police are not the problem to the District of Columbia's crime problem. Neither are they the solution, the exclusive solution to fixing it.
Attorney General Racine has made a habit of going after some fairly big national companies like Facebook, Amazon. He's even investigated President Trump's inaugural committee. What do you think about that kind of strategy? Do you intend to pursue a similar strategy going after big players? Will that be a priority for you if elected?
I think the Attorney General has done a really great job, along with his talented team of attorneys and non-attorney professionals, not simply after going after, you know, Amazon and Facebook, but also all the other things that they do within that office. I think the high profile cases stand out, and that wouldn't change if I'm elected attorney general. Those facts and evidence would lead us to filing those types of cases. But I think it's also important to recognize the myriad of work that they do within that office. They've done really great work under the attorney general's tenure, as well as under previous attorneys general. And so I appreciate that question. And if you violate the law, whether you are Facebook or Amazon or a CEO of either of those companies or other companies, then you will be public enemy number one in my administration.
You had a nice announcement ceremony yesterday on North Capitol Street up in front of the home that your grandfather first bought in 1952. I was looking up the neighborhood, and it's called Stronghold. You used to be the head of the Stronghold Civic Association. Why is it called Stronghold?
It is, first of all, my grandfather and my grandmother both purchased the house together back in 1952, and it's called Stronghold because of the youth in that community had teams, including baseball, football, basketball. They had cheerleaders and others in this close-knit, once blue-collar working-class community of people. And they together came up with that name, Stronghold. And I think it accurately reflects the resilience and the sense of love and community and service that still continues today. And I was proud to represent Stronghold as a civic association leader. And I'm proud to represent the ward.
Real quickly, because we're almost out of time. Are you endorsing a candidate to replace you in the Ward 5 race? I've communicated with Vincent Orange this week. He says he's getting in next week.
Well, I guess what, Tom, I think you know well, and Kojo knows as well, that Ward 5 are some of the smartest, most discerning voters in the District of Columbia.
You have a candidate. You're almost out of time. All right. Gordon Fletcher, Zachary Parker, Faith Gibson Hubbard are running, and Vincent Orange, a former Ward 5 member, is going to run. Do you have a candidate that you publicly support at this moment?
I have faith that Ward 5 voters will elect the best candidate to succeed me and build on the progress that we've achieved together.
That sounds like an endorsement.
Ken McDuffie is a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 5. His ambition is to be the next Attorney General of the District of Columbia. He's entering that race. Thank you very much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Next up is David Meyer, the CEO of the Washington Metropolitan Safety Commission. Tom Sherwood, Senate Democrats have removed a spending bill provision, the one that used to block D.C. legalizing marijuana sales, which the voters voted on since way back in maybe 2014, but which a certain Republican congressman from Maryland by the name of Andy Harris has always had a rider blocking that the city from being able to legalize marijuana in such a way that it could develop revenues from the sale of marijuana. It looks like if that is now about to go, but there are some other important developments that you can talk about that happened in this budget funding bill.
Well, the 2022 federal budget is important for the district. We know we are the most un-American place in America, even though we're the nation's capital, by the way we're treated here. And for many years, the district has been unable to license and regulate marijuana sales like Colorado in other states. And also, more importantly, in my mind, the district has been unable to spend its own money, its own local tax dollars or Medicaid federal dollars on abortion in this city for low-income women who need it. Both of those now, those are called riders, were removed or not included by the Senate committee when it put the budget together this week. And the House, I believe, is in concert with the Senate. If it doesn't, you know, get waylaid by some politics that I'm not aware of right now, Eleanor Holmes Norton, the delegate to Congress, will have achieved two of her very important victories up there on the Hill.
And let's turn to Maryland now, where Attorney General Brian Frosch has said that he is not going to seek re-election. We are very familiar with Brian Frosch around here. He's been on this broadcast a number of times. He's been in politics since 1986, and he's now saying that, well, that's enough of that for the time being. And Maryland State Treasurer Nancy Kopp is also saying the same thing, and that is that she's going to retire at the end of the year. What do you make of all of this?
Well, this is a huge, huge change. First, Brian Frosch has 36 years in public life, 2 terms as Attorney General, 20 years in the state Senate, 4 years in the state house from Montgomery County. At 75, unlike you and me, Kojo, he says he's done. So, you know, Bruce DuPort wrote in Maryland Matters this week that Frosch is, quote, viewed as a thoughtful, deliberate, and low-key politician who eschews the limelight. That is certainly true. He has done remarkably well in the state. He's had some fights with the current Republican governor. He has joined Carl Racine and other national attorneys general in fights with the Trump administration. But it's a big change. You know, there's some successors already being mentioned, as Anthony Brown, the congressman from Prince George's County, has told Maryland Matters he's seriously looking at running for attorney general, an office he almost ran for previously. And just last week, you know, we had State Senator Will Smith on the show, and we didn't get a chance to ask him, but he's looking at running for attorney general. And there are other potential candidates. There is one Republican who's already in the race, and that's Montgomery attorney James Shalek. But this is really opening up politics. And, you know, if the thing is, we're going to have all new, the Board of Public Works is the 3-member board that runs the state of Maryland. The governor, the attorney general, and the not the attorney general, the governor, the controller, and the treasurer. If things work out, we may have all 3 new members in 2023. Nancy Kopp, just know she's been there since 2002 as the treasurer, and she's retiring. She said she's done enough, and it's going to be interesting who gets appointed for that. It looks like it's going to be Derek Davis from Prince George's County. He has the Speaker of the House's, Adrian Jones's, support, and looks like he'll be the new treasurer for the legislature.
Let's turn to Virginia, where there's a close governor's race between the Democrat Terry McAuliffe and the Republican Glenn Youngkin. President Biden is going to be campaigning with McAuliffe in the home stretch of this race. McAuliffe has been calling in a lot of the Democratic Party bigwigs, including the president, including former President Obama and the current Vice President Kamala Harris. But is the presence of Joe Biden going to do him any good? Because there's an indication that Biden's ratings in Virginia have been falling.
I think it's kind of a cliche that, the national politics affects the Virginia race. I think it's a little overstated. Biden will be in Arlington on Tuesday, his second visit. Former President Obama, will be in Richmond on Saturday, tomorrow. The basic strategy here, in a very close race with Republican Glenn Youngkin, is to get out the vote in Northern Virginia. The Democrat can't just win in Northern Virginia. You have to win overwhelmingly 60, 70, 80% of the vote in Northern Virginia to offset the more rural parts of the state that vote for the Republican Glenn Youngkin. So that's what McAuliffe is doing. He's trying to rally the Democrats. They're a little too confident about victories, or they're worn out by politics with Trump gone. So will they vote? That's the key issue for McAuliffe. Glenn Youngkin just announced he's going to do a bus tour, a Win with Glenn bus tour, 50 jurisdictions over the next week, riding around in the fancy bus. I saw a picture of it. And then he's going to do a fly around the last weekend, going to Richmond, Virginia Beach, and Loudoun County. And that's because he's trying to pick off some of the suburban voters who have trended and voted Democratic the last 10 years. He thinks he has a shot, and so that's what he's doing.
He's hoping
that Trump doesn't decide to come into the state and campaign for him. It's the last thing he wants.
As Laura Vazella said, he has a complicated relationship with President Trump. As I said, joining us now is David Meyer, the CEO of the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission. David Meyer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Before we get into the safety issues with WMATA's 7000 series trains, can you briefly tell us what the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission is, and how do you work with WMATA?
Sure. We are the independent entity that's responsible for direct safety oversight of the Metro Rail system across DC, Maryland, and Virginia. We're known under federal law as a state safety oversight agency, and that's simply because in other parts of the country, the transit systems usually run in just one state, and it's a state department of transportation or a public utilities commission that typically performs the kind of oversight that we perform. We have technical experts in all areas of rail transportation and rail transportation safety, and we perform a day-to-day safety oversight of the system.
Your agency ordered WMATA to pull all 7,000 series cars from service after last Sunday's derailment on the Blue Line near Arlington Cemetery. The National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, is leading the investigation into safety issues with these trains. Can you explain what we know so far about what happened in layperson's terms, or are you muzzled on this issue?
Well, I'll do my best to explain what's known. I can talk to you maybe first a little bit about the actual event that occurred, and then we could get into, if it makes sense, we could then get into some of the actions after the accident.
Okay.
So at 4:51 p.m. on Tuesday, October 12th, Blue Line Train 407 was operating southbound on Track 2 when it derailed just outside Roslyn Station, headed in the direction of Arlington Cemetery Station. It was an 8-car, 7,000 series train, and the only car that derailed was car number 7200. It was actually just one axle of that car that derailed. And as you just said, the NTSB is leading the accident investigation, and we're continuing to work with them on the investigation. Now, the NTSB has said that train 407 had derailed at least two other times on the day of the accident, but each time the train re-railed itself. So it first derailed northbound near Arlington Cemetery Station and later near Largo Town Center Station on a trip that ended with the accident derailment at 4:51 p.m. on that day. Of course, the train did not re-rail itself after that derailment.
Here's Tom Sherwood. Mr. Meyer, Tom Sherwood here. Thank you very much for joining us today. The general manager of Metro, Paul Wiedefeld, and the chairman of the board of Metro, Paul Smedberg, had a press conference this morning. I could not go. Were you there for that?
No, I was not there. I was aware they held a press conference, but I wasn't present for it.
Okay, great. They announced that the shutdown, the reduced rail cars, 60% of the rail cars, would continue at least until next week. It was your organization. I don't think people know this. Your organization, you ordered Metro to shut down on Monday morning. Did you also tell them to keep it closed for another week? How is that decision being made?
So we learned that Metro was conducting special inspections of all of the axles on its 7,000 series cars during the weekend. And by Sunday afternoon, with about half the 7,000 series fleet inspected, we learned that inspectors were finding several dozen 7,000 series axles with what are called wheel gauge defects, outward movement of the wheels, which create a risk of derailment.
Right. Did you,
consequently, we decided to issue our order Sunday evening.
And Mr. Meyer, I mean, did you order the additional week, or is that just something they've done because they recognize they can't meet the safety requirements that you've asked them to meet? That's
so our order doesn't actually contain any time component. What our order said was that Metro had to remove the 7,000 series rail cars from passenger rail service and provide a plan for the detection and prevention of wheel gauge anomalies in the rail cars, and that Metro needs to implement a plan that provides for the safe to return to revenue service of each car in the 7,000 fleet.
All right, Director Meyer, I do hope complaint I've heard from a variety of people associated with Metro is that Metro doesn't respond more quickly enough to the Metro Rail Safety Commission directions and recommendations. The National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Jennifer Homendy said this week, quote, this could have resulted in a catastrophic event. Do you agree with her?
We certainly take no exception to that statement. We take our safety responsibilities very seriously, and that's why we issued the order that we issued.
But the NTSB said that Metro has reported 31 instances of this wheel problem over the past 4 years, with many of them happening in the past year. Your agency, the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission, was just created in the past 2 years specifically to address these kinds of issues. Is this recurring wheel issue something Metro should have been telling you about? And why didn't they? We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back, and you can hold your answer until we do that. I'm Kojo Nand. Welcome back. Our guest is David Meyer, the CEO of the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission. David Meyer was telling you that this has happened 31 times in the past 4 years, and wondering whether or not Metro has been telling you about this.
We learned about it in the context of the safety investigation over the weekend. So your question, should Metro have disclosed this? I certainly think so. And they are required to disclose safety concerns and safety deficiencies to us.
What if they don't?
We have biweekly meetings with the railcar engineering staff, the chief mechanical officer, and we always ask specifically for any safety issues that are known, and Metro did not share this. In fact, in September, we published a detailed safety audit of WMATA's passenger rail cars, and we made a number of very specific requests as well as open-ended questions, and Metro did not disclose this defect to us. So I'm very disappointed that we didn't learn about this before the derailment.
I think this is one of the most extraordinary things. I think Paul Wiedefeld, as the general manager for the last 6 years, has gotten great respect for the things he's tried to do to make the system work. That recently, as you well know, there's been feelings that the Metro was on its way back to good, to use a phrase. But this seems extraordinary that the axle, this issue, was not brought to the safety, Metro Rail Safety Commission. I mean, there seems to be, ought to be something in response to that. Does the department, you can't answer this question, I'm going to ask it. Is it time maybe for a new general manager?
Well, I certainly can't answer that question. I can tell you that the investigation will gather information about exactly how Metro understood this condition and what they were doing to address it and how they were interacting with the car builder. And we'll take all that into consideration.
One thing that bothered me is that in the response, the Metro, of course, announced a bureaucratic move in saying that it would hire outside experts to look at how Metro is run to see what should be done or shouldn't be done. It seems to me that Metro, ought to hire the experts to work for Metro.
Well, Metro absolutely does have a safety department that has a rail expertise and very capable people who work in that department, just like they have a Metro Rail Safety Commission that also has very capable people who provide safety oversight to the system.
Well, obviously, you're waiting for the results of this investigation, but at today's press conference, Board Chair Paul Smedberg said he still had confidence in both General Manager Paul Wiedefeld and the leadership team, even though Smedberg said the Board of Directors itself had no knowledge of the issue with the wheels. How about your own view? You still have faith in the leadership team, or are you waiting for the results of this investigation before you make that decision?
Well, I want to stress that we are a part of this investigation, and we are a party to the NTSB's investigation. We are participating quite actively in the investigation, and in fact, within the investigation, we're even leading some aspects of it. So I definitely want to make sure that you and your listeners understand that we're not a passive participant or a passive recipient of the investigative information.
We got this tweet from Mr. T. in D.C., who says, I don't understand why they can't thoroughly examine the axles on a 7000 series car, determine that particular car is fine, and release them into service one at a time. To which you say, what, David Meyer?
That's a very good question. Why can't Metro simply inspect the cars and, if they're safe, put them back into service? It appears that what we're looking at here is a progressive failure. In other words, a defect in railroad speed that occurs while the cars are in service and gets worse as the cars are in service. So just because a car is safe on day one doesn't mean that it will remain safe over its duration in service. At the core of this matter is determining the appropriate inspection interval to make sure that this defect, this problem is caught before a derailment occurs.
Let me ask a question about that. Obviously, a corporation or company made these cars. Where's the liability? Is it that Metro accepted the cars and inspected them and said, okay, they're good, they meet our specifications? Was it a flaw in the design of the wheel gauge? Was it a mistake by the manufacturer? Where's the liability for this? Because this is extraordinary if these cars are not going to be able to be used unless the wheels are changed.
Well, I guess what I could say in response to that is, you know, I'm a safety guy. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a liability guy. I do know that like every transit operator, rail car operator, Metro creates specifications and car builders build cars to specifications. But some of your specific questions about who exactly contributed to what or what company did what, that's going to all be part of the NTSB investigation. So I can't get out ahead of that because it's just not done yet.
You were for 4 years, I think you did safety work for the New York subway system. Is that correct?
That's right. I began my career actually working for the National Transportation Safety Board, and for the few years before I came to work for the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission, I was the chief safety officer of the MTA in New York.
Answer the big question. Washington Post columnist Teresa Vargas wrote this week that this incident shows Metro has, quote, little consideration of the lives of the people, unquote, who use it. How do you get the reputation back?
Well, that's obviously a question for Metro to get its reputation back and for Metro to move forward from this. But actions speak loudly, and I think that we will all be looking for Metro to get a good firm handle on this particular issue and any other issues that arise, speak transparently about them, and move forward.
Our caller Cedric is still with us. Cedric, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good afternoon, Bill Joe. My question is that I was just wondering, does Metro, when they do series cars upgrades, do they have a Metro employee that works as a COTAR, which stands for a Contracting Officer's Technical Representative for Metro or WMATA, to make sure that all technical matters are met by the awarded contractor?
Are there a second set of eyes, is what Cedric seems to be asking, David Meyer?
Well, in this region, particularly because of the federal presence, understands what a COTAR is, a contracting officer's technical representative. I would say that Metro, like all transit properties that's accepting rail cars that are built to its specifications, Metro has a very detailed testing and acceptance procedure that it goes through for each and every rail car that's delivered to it. But Metro would really have to speak to exactly what that entails.
Cedric, thank you for your call. The 7,000 series trains make up 60% of Metro's fleet, so pulling them out of service has had major impacts, and at today's press conference, General Manager Paul Wiedefel said the low service levels will last at least through October 31st. This all comes as the region is attempting to reopen, and it certainly puts a big speed bump in that recovery. Your role, obviously, is in safety, but how do service impacts weigh on your decisions?
Well, you know, we are really laser focused on safety, and the issue was whether or not it was safe for Metro to return to a normal level of rush hour service on the Monday following our order, and we decided that was not appropriate to do. I mean, it's affected my own travel in the Metro Rail system, but our focus is truly that of safety, not service delivery.
You made it clear that you are a part of this investigation. You're not standing on the side watching it. What is the funding just for the Metro Rail Safety Commission? Where do your funds come from?
So we are a creature of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia in a very similar way that so is WMATA. But our funding is entirely separate from WMATA.
What's the
we
budget?
We have a budget process that derives our funding from the three jurisdictions, and a good bit of our activity, just like all of our sister agencies around the country, is funded through federal grant funds.
What's your overall budget, and is your commission strong enough? Do you need more money? Do you need more experts, need more staff? Are you okay with how your office is running as you look into this terrible situation at Metro?
Well, very honestly, as the dust settles on this activity, we will take a hard look at our operations and our own staffing and funding. But I'll tell you, we are well funded compared to our sister agencies and have a significant number of resources that many of our sister agencies, I think, would be envious of. That said, we will take a hard look and see whether or not we need to make any changes or any increases to our staffing.
And finally, it seems like we hear about problem after problem from the Metro Rail Safety Commission, like the red line train separation in 2020 or the more recent report in August that says Metro doesn't properly track operator fatigue. But we don't hear about improvements made by Metro after these reports come out. Does WMATA generally address these issues in a timely manner?
One of the core functions, yes, is the answer, and one of the core functions that we have is managing an inventory of corrective action plans that arise from our audits and from the safety investigations. Some of the corrective actions can be implemented quickly, others take time. We manage a Metro's portfolio of corrective action plans to make sure that mitigations and safety improvements result from these activities.
David Myers, the CEO of the Metro, of the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission. David Myers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Moving on now to Steve Martin, who's a former program director for WAMU. Why Steve Martin is with us is because WAMU is celebrating 60 years of existence, and he can give us some history of how this broadcast, now known as the Politics Hour, came into existence. Steve Martin, thank you so much for joining us. Good to talk to you.
Kojo, it's so great to be talking with you, but you're making me feel old. 60 years of WAMU, 30 years of this program.
Exactly right.
Is this the person who created Mark Plotkin? Let's get right
to the heart of invented him out of whole cloth?
I was going to say the origin, of course, goes back to Mark Plotkin, and he often would say to me, you know, I would say, I guess I get credit for this, he said, or the blame. But this program certainly would not exist had it not been for Mark Plotkin. He convinced me early on in the late 80s, early 90s to put him on the radio. And we had just a very innocent conversation one day where I said, why don't you go on with Mike Cuthbert in the evening and talk about D.C. politics, maybe every couple of weeks. And they started doing that, and it just clicked with the audience. And then when Derek McGinty came along and we put the program on during the weekday, Fridays at 12 noon, with Mark doing his thing and Derek, they had a great rapport, and off it went, became one of the most listened to hours on the station.
Steve Martin, what was the idea behind the show, and what role did it fill in the media landscape?
Well, as I say, it came about pretty much in the early 90s when Mark Plotkin came to me with his passion. I was reading his obituary, unfortunately, reminding me of how he was described as the cantankerous, sometimes bombastic commentator and a rabble-rouser. And he convinced me that we should pay close attention to D.C. politics and focus on the district. Kim Hodgson, who was the general manager at the time, he and I felt like WAMU should be a district radio station, and we didn't have a lot of resources at the time, so we couldn't cover too much of what was happening in the region, but we could focus in on D.C. And it was a time when Mayor Marion Barry, of course, was in office. There was talk about Jesse Jackson maybe running for mayor. Some of the old-timers will remember that. And then, of course, the mayor was arrested, and things became quite fascinating. And it was just a sense that we needed to really focus in on what was happening with the core city of the region.
As we mentioned, Mark Plotkin is no longer with us. He passed in 2019, but he often described himself as a major peripheral figure. This is how he talked about himself. But when did you know that the Politics Hour was a success, the D.C. Politics Hour?
Well, a couple of things that we knew pretty quickly is we, you know, do get audience numbers, and we started to see that more and more people were tuning in. But, of course, during the fund drives, fundraising campaigns, people were calling in great numbers. But I think the thing where we really realized it was catching on was one evening before the show had actually gone to daytime. Mark was talking about, I believe his name was David Clark, right?
I got a story about that, but go ahead.
Yeah. And Derek McGinty's eyes got really big, and he's looking at the computer screen and pointing to it. And Mark is like, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Well, David Clark's on the phone." And Mark came to me the next day, and he said, "This thing is working." He said, "People are listening to this, and they're calling in."
That's David Clark, so which people should know was a former Ward 1 council member, then chairman of the council about the time he called in.
And when he became chairman of the council, Mark tells the story that he approached David Clark, asked for a meeting. David Clark had him in his office, and Mark went to him and read down the laundry list of all of the things he wanted David Clark to do as chair of the council. And he said David Clark listened to him quietly the entire time. And then when he was finished, David Clark stood up all 6'5" of him and looked at Mark and said, "Out! Out! Out!" I asked Mark what he did, and Mark said, "The man's 6'5", I left."
Well, you know, I have to say, you know, Steve, you have been here for a long time. I haven't been here that long. But, you know, I would tell you with my funny voice, where I go into Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., you know, even when I worked for 28 years for Channel 4 News, where people knew me by face, I was stunned by the number of people wherever I was who might hear my voice, and they would turn and say, "You're on the radio." They weren't quite sure of my name, but it's like, and then they'd pause and say, "You're Kojo." I said, "I'm not Kojo." No, but no, they would think the penetration of the program is always something that I am surprised about. It. I was at Harris Teeter after we got our DC flag tattoos a few years ago as part of a fundraising, and this couple came up to me, and one of them, she said, "Show us your tattoo." And I said, "You want me to take my shirt off here in Harris Teeter?" And yes. I said, "I don't think I'll do that." I showed him a picture of it. But the penetration of the show is remarkable.
And I'm glad Tom raised that issue, Steve, because you were the one who was responsible for hiring me all those years ago after Mark Plotkin first came to me to ask me to do it and then came to you to ask you to hire me.
To
and
make
then,
him do it.
And then I came to you, but that was before our current resident grouch, Tom Sherwood, came along. I'm curious, how do you feel the show changed when Tom Sherwood joined us?
It was more factual.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
How do you feel about Tom's joining us, Steve? Because you're a radio analyst.
These answers have not been rehearsed either. What's the answer to that question? Now,
The program is just, you know, it has been so encouraging to see over the years. You know, of course, with Mark, it was, you know, a lot of his personality and his confronting politicians and so forth. I feel like over the years it has evolved into a, as you would say, I guess maybe a slightly more serious weekly dive into what's going on in the community. Adding somebody like Tom, is, though he says he hasn't been around that long, he's been around a long time. He knows all the players. He knows what's going on in the area. And just like I've been listening, you know, today, obviously, from noon on, and, you know, the level of discussion, the amount of information that gets across to people is I feel extremely proud to have played a little bit of a role.
And Tom, of course, has had experience covering the state of Virginia when he was with the Washington Post, and he takes a great deal of interest in what goes on in Maryland also. And so we're no longer the D.C. Politics Hour, but it's now the Politics Hour. But I wanted to go back to June of 2000 when we held a very special event called The Roast of Plotkin. It was a special evening where local officials, including all four living mayors, came to roast Plotkin. Steve, what do you remember from that evening, which, as I recall, Plotkin mostly kind of organized himself?
He really did. It was crazy. He was always a great one, as you know, Kojo, for throwing his own parties.
Exactly. For honoring himself.
That's right. If somebody wasn't going to do it, he was going to make sure it happened. And, you know, I don't recall the exact origin of the idea, but he decided to do this roast, and it was promoted so much as, you know, Mark will be quiet. And I stood in that room that night, and my breath just was taken away, because every local politician, government official, you know, everyone who was anyone was in that room, all the former mayors. And they, you know, it was a fun evening. Mark, of course, made it appear to be like a a convention. He had the flags on all the tables marking the different wards and cities. And it just really said to me, wow, we at WAMU had really accomplished something. We had really made the station part of the community and part of the city in ways that when I arrived in the early 80s and it was just kind of a sleepy public radio station, had really become an important part of the media landscape in the city and in the region.
And Mark, of course, had a contentious relationship with a lot of people during his lifetime. As a matter of fact, one of the speakers at that 2000 event is sitting in front of me now, Tom Sherwood, who on that evening, speaking of Mark's contentious relationship, said, "Mark has stopped speaking to more people than I have ever met in my life." And apparently Mark did not himself observe that and felt it was an omission. And so soon after that, he stopped speaking to Tom.
Well, that's true. He was, but, you know, I think what it shows, though, when Mark's passion for politics shows that politics and the politics hour is not, as I like to say, a dry recitation of a 3-point public policy program that you've thought up for the last 5 years. It's how did you get here? What does it mean? Who are you including in and who are you including out? It's the give and take, the contact sport of politics that makes it interesting as well as important.
Indeed.
Yeah, that was...
Go ahead, please.
If I could say, the thing about Mark that struck me was that he brought the politics from the ground level. He was very interested in the interaction of politicians with citizens and how things happened on the ground. He was far from being kind of an ivory tower analyst.
How did this program get to be all about Mark Plotkin? What about Kojo?
Because Plotkin was essentially the founder of the program. And when we started out doing something called WAMU in your ward several years ago, that was Mark Plotkin and yours truly going out into various communities in DC. That's now been expanded to Kojo in our community, so we go all around the region at this point. But it was Mark Plotkin who's brought this idea and Steve Martin who was able to get it implemented, and so we're very happy to have you here as WAMU looks at celebrating 60 years of existence. Before we go, let's give a chance for Rob in Arlington to say something. Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo, Tom, thank you for taking my call. You had said, Kojo, about a few minutes ago, how long do you want this show to go on? So I listen. I've been listening for 10, 12 years, whatever, get a kick out of you and Tom especially. Even when I'm out of town, I'm retired from the Navy, but when I travel, I would always web in, you know, on my smartphone and listen to you guys because it's such a hoot. And that I hope that you guys can get, like, youth serum injections and stick around for another 30 or 40 years because, as I say, I listen every Friday that I can because it's a great show.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. Tom and I would like to believe that we take ourselves very seriously, so please don't tell anyone how much fun we have actually doing this. And that was Mark's attitude, too. Steve Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Kojo. Everybody, congratulations on doing great and important radio. I appreciate it.
Steve Martin is a former program director for WAMU. And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. As I mentioned earlier, WAMU is celebrating its 60th anniversary this week. Tom Sherwood, any big plans this weekend besides listening to the show for the next hour?
I'm going to be paying attention to the Virginia governor's race and going down to the wire the last 8-9 days. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens on November the 2nd.
Thank you all for listening. And Tom Sherwood, you have a great weekend. You too all have a great weekend and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nam.
Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobsdorf. Today's engineer was Kellen Quigley, and our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Mana Kashfi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.